This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Fantasy freaks and geeks, it's James Kell from the Sleeper King Football Podcast. We all know sleepers can win you championships, but finding these guys takes time. That's where the Sleeper King comes in. Let me do all the research so you don't have to. Every week, I'm going to break down which sleepers you need to pick up off the waiver wire and which surprise deep sleepers could help you win the week. Every episode, just 15 to 20 minutes long, every Tuesday through Friday. Subscribe to the Sleeper King Football Podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your pods.
The number one overall pick, the Washington Nationals.
Wow, Matt Adams.
Yeah, they realized it when they saw number two pop up and it wasn't their name. But the Nats won the lottery. They had, I think, the fourth best odds to do it. And they will pick first in the MLB draft next July. Joining us right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline, is our good friend Mark Zuckerman from Masson. You can follow Mark on Twitter at Mark, Z-U-C-K-E-R-M-A-N, and read him at MassonSports.com. So I think the question, once they once they got lucky, the fourth best odds, right? Am I right about that?
Yeah, fourth best, but it was only 10%. So, I mean, the way this is designed, it gives two teams at the top about a 25% chance, and everybody else is pretty low. And so I don't think they really went into this seriously thinking they were going to get it. They knew there was a chance, but I don't think they went into this saying, oh, yeah, there's a great chance of this happening tonight.
What were their odds in 22 when they got Cruz?
I think that was 25% also. They were one of the top teams. So that was coming off the 100-loss season. So
yeah.
They do give the teams with the worst record a slightly better chance. But it's basically a new thing that just started a few years ago to try to prevent full-on tanking and guarantee the number one pick like they got 15 years ago with Strasburg and Harper back-to-back when they did have the worst record back-to-back years.
You wrote, by the way, in your summary of last night, they technically did win the 2023 lottery but were ineligible to hold the number one pick. Give me the circumstances around that again.
Yeah, it's a little convoluted, but the way that the rules for this work are, and again, trying to prevent teams from consistently losing every year, if you're in a lottery once, then you're not allowed to be in it the next year if you pay into revenue sharing, if you're considered a big market club. And I know there are people who are going to debate whether this is fair or not as it pertains to the Nationals, but by definition, they are a revenue-paying club, not receiving club, and so they were ineligible for that. But they went ahead and, I don't understand the math of it, but I guess the odds of it have to stay the same, so you run the thing as if everybody's in it. And they happened to win, and they said, well, that's ineligible, so we have to do it again. So we found that out after the fact, but yeah, in a bizarre way,
why were they even in it
last year?
Why'd they even put them in it?
Yeah, it had to do with the statistics of it. If you take the team out of it,
the odds change. Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned it, Strasburg in 2009, Harper in 2010. Is there a Strasburg or a Harper in 2025?
It's a little early to come right out and say that, and I think everybody knew at that time that there were some like all-time prospects in those 2 years. The name, and it'll be a name that the last name will certainly mean something to people, is Ethan Holliday. And yes, that's Jackson Holliday's brother and Matt Holliday's son. Jackson, the number one pick of the Orioles 2 years ago, Matt, the former all-star outfielder for the Rockies and the Cardinals. Probably the early favorite on it, but I don't know at this stage that you can say it's a slam dunk that he'll be the guy. He certainly has the genetics, the bloodline, and everything for that. Now, the key there is he's a high schooler from Oklahoma. He's 17 years old. He's still got to play his senior season, and a lot can happen between now and next July, and there'll be a few other players that they look at closely. But they know whoever it is, it's going to be a big-time impact player, the likes of which they only get an opportunity to draft every once in a while. And let's point out that Dylan Cruz, well, technically the number two pick 2 years ago, almost any year would have been the slam dunk number one pick, and it's just because of his LSU teammate Paul Skeens
right.
that he wasn't. So if you're the Nationals, it's pretty fortuitous that the years you happen to be in this position are years where some pretty big-name players were available.
And maybe I just missed this. What position does he play?
Holiday is a shortstop. Shortstop, maybe third base.
Okay. Real quickly, who was the better prospect? I know that they were both considered generational, but who actually, from a ranking standpoint or from a score standpoint, with whomever you follow when it comes to draft rankings, who was the better prospect, Strasburg or Harper?
Oh, that's a great question. I think Harper was probably the more slam dunk. Like, people knew who he was when he was 13 years old and he was hitting 500-foot homers. In high school home run derbies. So I think there was always the belief there that he was going to be a superstar. Whereas Strasburg, it really was just that last year at San Diego State that he took off, and it kind of like Skeens in a way at LSU. Now, by the time of the draft, Strasburg was viewed as this generational player and certainly as a pitcher. I think most scouts, given the choice between a position player and a pitcher, would tell you that the position player is the better prospect just because they can contribute more and there's less margin for error as with a pitcher who can get hurt, which, as we saw, was often the case for Strasburg. But it's also why, say the Pirates took Skeens over Cruz, because all things being equal, it can be a lot harder to get that iconic starting pitcher. There are fewer of them out there than iconic hitters. So you could see it going both ways. But I would guess that at the time people would have said Harper was a little bit ahead of Strasburg.
You know, just real quickly, on that draft where the Pirates took Skeens and Washington took Cruz, the other player that was in consideration, wasn't it Langford?
Yeah, for the Rangers, and he went actually fourth. He didn't even go third.
Right, so if you redo that draft, do the Pirates still take Skeens? Probably yes, right?
Oh, yeah. He was so good. Rookie of the year. I mean, he was a Cy Young finalist.
Yeah, of course.
And I think the Nats still take Dylan Cruz. We only saw a little bit of him, and we'll see. But it was notable that Langford, who some people thought could have been number one himself, that he was the first one to reach the big leagues and may ultimately be as good, if not better, player in the long run.
All right. So we've got months to kind of follow the upcoming season and the back and forth on mock drafts for the Nats and who will go number one. So we'll circle back to that when we get there. I'm glad you're on, because obviously there's been a big conversation here the last few days after Juan Soto signed the 15-year, $765 million deal with the Mets. And part of that conversation, of course, is, what are the Washington Nationals really in the larger scheme of baseball and, true, ability to compete at the highest levels. I'm just curious as to what your thoughts are. I know that I knew that we were not going to get Soto. Everybody understood that. But him landing in the division with Harper in Philadelphia, with Atlanta having a great team, as improved as the Nats may be, it's a tough hill to climb. And part of it has to fall back on ownership, doesn't it?
Yeah, I understand why so many people would be disheartened by it. Nobody wanted to see him stay in division. If he had just stayed with the Yankees or gone to the Red Sox or somebody else, everyone would be disappointed, but I don't think it would be the same as, he's staying in the division and he's going to the Mets of all teams. So there's obviously going to be frustration over that and disappointment over that, and a lot of asking of questions of, the what if and what if anything, could or should the Nationals have done differently. And I've gone through that question in my head plenty of times over the last 2 years since they traded him. I think what I really came down to, and as hard as it's going to be to accept, but I think it's the truth, I don't think they ever had any chance of locking him up before he became a free agent. I mean, look at how this played out. It's exactly how he and Scott Boras would have hoped it would. A gargantuan record-setting deal that was only available because he made it to free agency and had the ability to get multiple teams bidding against each other. You're not going to get that if one team has all the leverage because nobody else is in the competition. Now, you can say the Nats could have offered more in 2022, and they could have. I don't think he would have taken it. I think he was smart enough and Boras was smart enough to say that you will always do better. Barring injury, you will always do better if you wait it out. That's the way the system is designed, and that's what happened. Now, should the Nats have been involved? Should they have at least tried to make an offer? And we don't believe they did this time around. I would have liked to see that, even if there was a realization that he probably wasn't coming back here, even if you knew deep down you're not going to outbid Steve Cohen of the Mets. If nothing else, to kind of show your fan base and show the rest of baseball that you are serious about going after big free agents again. You know, you don't have to get him, but you can at least show everyone else, okay, hey, the Nationals are a team to consider. And as far as we can tell, they didn't do that. So there is a lot of pressure on them right now, the rest of this winter, to see what they do. They don't have to sign the biggest name, but they need to show that they are committed again to signing players of consequence to deals of more than, you know, 1 or 2 years, an attempt to try to win again. Because I think a lot of people, fans and team people with the team themselves, feel like it's time, that the rebuild needs to move into the next phase.
I mean, I understand the difference, by the way, between Harper and Soto. One was a free agent, the other was traded. But they still lost both of them. In hindsight, is it kind of clear that Harper was the one that was much more likely, or there's a much better chance, let me rephrase, a much better chance to keep than Soto?
Potentially, although, deep down I still, he's represented by Boras too, and he was a guy who was determined to get the biggest contract he could. Now, what's interesting is the market for Harper wasn't nearly what he probably thought it was going to be. I still believe to this day that he wanted to go somewhere else, to L.A., Chicago, New York, and those teams weren't really involved, and the Phillies were kind of the only one that made a big-time offer, and in the end, he got the total number that made it record-setting, but year by year, it was not. And so it was almost a little disappointing. Now, I think now he's fine with how it worked out. He's on a good team. He's been to the World Series. He's, still playing at an elite level, and is probably going to be a Hall of Famer. But at the time, there probably was a better chance of the Nationals competing with that offer, because as it turned out, there weren't as many of them. And at that point, all he knows are the Nationals. And let's also remember, in the winter of 2018, that's still a team with star players trying to win a World Series, which they did the year after he left. By the time they got to Soto in 2022, and he still got a couple years left before he's a free agent, the team was already on its way to 100 losses. It had already traded Scherzer and Turner. The rebuild had begun. So if you're Soto and winning matters to you, and I do think it matters to him, that was a tougher sell, I think, at that point to try to get him to stay than it would have been for Harper, who, had they found the dollar amount that worked, he knew he would be sticking with a team that was positioned to continue to win.
Yeah, look, I know what you're saying, and certainly the $440 million offer 2 years ago, I think everybody kind of has said since the weekend that Boras, and probably well before that, Boras was never not going to take this player to free agency. And so the Nats really didn't have a chance. I guess the frustration would be, the Nats are, top half of Major League Baseball in revenue. And the fact that, once they realize Boras would take him to free agency, so they make the trade, and that's good. That's good management, roster management by Rizzo. The fact that they're not even thought of and not even close to a player when this player became a free agent again is, I think, the frustration. It's like they're not going to play in these waters. No chance, right?
Well, they weren't right now, no. And I think that's why these next steps are so important. If they really are ready to take the next step as a team. And if they believe that this new young core of players, Wood and Cruz and Abrams and Gore, if that team is ready to start winning, there's going to be a point here, whether it's this winter or pretty soon after that, where they have to supplement that with real food. And whether we're going to get into the same cycle again of someday having to decide, can they retain Wood or Cruz or Abrams? Can they convince any of them to stay? Or can they go sign, you know, the Max Scherzer free agent who can come in and take a team over the top? That's what we still have to see from them. And we don't know the answer to that, other than some cryptic remarks in the past from Mark Lerner to suggest that, you know, when the time is right, we will spend. I know Mike Rizzo wants to. I think he believes the time is right. It's
right.
A question of, has he been told he can or not? And so, yeah, this is an inflection point for ownership to say, yes, we're back in the game, or no, we're not, and now you're operating like the Tampa Bay Rays, and you may have some success, but can you sustain it? And are you constantly having to look to trade guys once their salaries get to be too high?
All right, I want to come back to, you know, the time being right and what you think they should do. But, and we're talking to Mark Zuckerman, of course. But the one thing that I said this to Tommy the other day, given that there was probably zero chance that Juan Soto was going to sign a contract with the Nationals or anybody else 2 years ago, they probably should have offered more. It would have looked better. Like, no one's blaming the Yankees for not signing Soto. They offered him $760 million. And 2 years ago, something $500 million or north of, from a perception standpoint, it would have, I think, made them look like they were much more willing than the offer they made, which I'm not saying was a bad offer at all. It's still outrageous money. But knowing that they weren't going to accept anything, they should have offered something north of $500 million. What do you think?
I think that's a fair take to have on it. And what we're really talking about here is not negotiations for the purpose of trying to sign a player, but negotiations for PR purposes.
No
doubt. And maybe this is where they haven't done as well. And it can apply to the Harper situation as well, that they offered him $300 million. But, you know, as we've seen often with their offers, they include deferments and things that some players don't like and can come across from a PR standpoint as not the best they could have done.
Right.
And whether it would have made a difference, who knows? But it's harder now to go and say, well, hey, we did everything we could. It's not our fault. So, yeah. I think from a PR standpoint, there were probably steps they could have taken to come out of it looking a little better than they did. Now, in the end, the proof is going to be this. Did the players they got for Juan Soto, Wood, Gore, Abrams in particular, we might see Hassel in the big leagues in the next year as well, do they become stars and become stars on a team that wins and gets back to the playoffs again? And if that happens, then you can save face from it all and say, yeah, we had a generational player, but look what we turned that into. Because here's the fact of the matter was this. At that time, Juan Soto alone wasn't going to help the Nationals become a winning team again. They had too many other problems. And that's their own fault. Let's be clear of that. They did not draft or develop anywhere close to well enough to take what was a championship roster in 19 and reinforce it with a new group of young players who could kind of be that next generation. And so the real reason they traded Soto, it's not just because of the contract. It's because they knew we don't have a farm system good enough to develop a winner before he can become a free agent. Our only hope of becoming right. a winning team again is to trade him now while we can get the most for him. So that's their fault. They put themselves in that position, but that's why they got to where they did.
All right. You said, Mark Lerner said, when the time is right. I kind of sense that you think the time is right. You said Rizzo thinks the time is right. So what do you think they'll do? What should they do?
It's a critical offseason for them. I do believe that. And I know a lot of people are frustrated. They haven't done anything yet. They haven't signed anybody yet. But most free agents haven't signed yet. I think everyone was waiting for Soto and then see if the dominoes start to fall. There were a few of them. The Yankees signed Max Fried, a huge deal. Last night. So I think in the coming weeks we'll see more. Do they go big? Is it a Pete Alonso to play first base? I mean, they need a power-hitting first baseman for sure. Are they going to go all in on somebody like that? Would they go for an ace pitcher like Corbin Burns? That would be the big-time headline-grabbing moves. I don't necessarily think they have to go that far, though. I think they need to look at what they specifically need. Like I said, a power hitting first baseman. So a guy named Christian Walker from the Diamondbacks. 3 straight years, he's hit like 30 homers and won a Gold Glove Award. That's the kind of player they need. You can get him for like 3 years, not 10 years or 7 years, anything like that. Somebody like that. A good quality starting pitcher who can help lead that young staff and take over the role that Patrick Corbin held, hopefully pitching a lot better than Corbin did. A couple of relievers. You need a closer now that you dropped Finnegan. So those are not insignificant moves, but they're not gargantuan moves. But I think if done the right way, you spend some money on that, you can have a team that looks like it could be competitive next year if the young guys develop as you hope that they will. I think at minimum, you have to be looking at that kind of stuff. In a perfect world, they're all in on some of the bigger names, but we just haven't seen evidence yet to know if they are going to go that way.
You know, I read about Alonso the other day and the possibility of perhaps Washington landing him, that it's the Soto deal that would keep Steve Cohen from being able to put together a competitive offer for Alonso. I don't think there's a way to keep him from putting a competitive offer. He has shown willingly over and over again, a guy that's worth $23 to $25 billion, that he doesn't care. He just wants to win. I mean, don't you think there's a chance Alonso stays in New York or not?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Steve Cohen doesn't care about luxury taxes. He doesn't care about anything else. And I think it's an instructive point, and it kind of applies to what we were talking about earlier, too. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. What teams and specifically what owners are most desperate to win? That's really what this boils down to. Steve Cohen is desperate to win because the Mets haven't won a World Series since 1986, and he was a fan of that team his whole life, and now he owns them and he has unlimited resources. He's desperate. The Phillies have been desperate the last few years to get back to where they were.
Yeah.
The Yankees were kind of desperate to do it. The Dodgers maybe were, but not so much anymore because they've won. So the Nationals, they were desperate from 2012 to 2019. Ted Lerner did everything he could to try to win a World Series while he was still alive. They did it. As much as we want to believe they still have that same feeling now to try to get back there again, it's still too fresh. It's only 5 years. And that's annoying. That's frustrating to a lot of people. But I don't think they have the same motivation that a Steve Cohen does. And when it boils down to that, it's almost like you're helpless. You can't take down somebody who's that desperate and willing to spend whatever it takes.
I would think the Red Sox are near the top of that list, too.
They should be. There's a lot of frustration there, yeah. The Padres, we've seen, they have been the last few years.
Cubs.
And that's who you're dealing with. And so desperation's a powerful tool in this sport. The Nationals had it for about a good decade.
It'd be nice if they had some right now, because it feels like 2019 was 20 years ago at this point, which, by the way, was when they moved from Montreal here. And I wanted to mention real quickly, because I read this earlier this morning, knowing that you were coming on the show, Mark's putting together a list of the 20 greatest players in Nats history. He's counting it down from 20 to 1, and he's got his first five. You can read it by going to massinsports.com or just going and following Mark on Twitter and clicking it on. But I love those kinds of things. So that's a good read here over the next few weeks. Appreciate it as always.
You got it. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah. Mark Zuckerman, everybody. We'll do Denton's top five burning NFL questions next.